Good morning, everybody.
This week's parsha is Parshat Chukat. Parshat Chukat is going to take the Jewish people on an important journey. They are going to, for the first time, come into contact with other nations. 39 years have passed now, and the fact is that in between one pasuk and another in Parashat Chukat, 39 years pass with absolutely no comment. The parasha begins with the law of Torah Duma, the red heifer, which ends at the end of chapter 19. Pasuk 1 in chapter 20 begins by Yavo b'nei Yisrael kol ha'eda midbar tzin. The children of Israel, the entire community, came to the desert of Tzin. What's happened between the last pasuk in Parashat Torah and this pasuk in the no space between one pasuk and the next, 39 years have passed. It's the 40th year. It's all gone. In this parasha, Jews are going to come in contact for the first time with other nations. Edom, Canaan, Amori, Ammon and Moab. If you will, Jewish foreign relations begin in Parashat Chukat. And what we're going to do is we're going to investigate some of these contacts. We're going to see their importance and their relevance. Let's go one step further. Let's say that for all intents and purposes, the history of the Jewish people as a nation amongst the nations of the world begins in Parashat Chukat. For 40 years they have been in absolute isolation, cut off from the rest of the world, no contact, no relationships. 40 years they've been in the desert. No, they've had no contact with anyone. They've had no formal relationship with any people on the face of this earth. It's only now, Parashat Chukat, that they're going to come into contact and all sorts of relationships, for better or for worse, are going to develop now. Since, I believe, Parashat Chukat is the beginning of Jewish history. And when I say the beginning of Jewish history of course begins with Avraham Avinu. But it is the beginning of Jewish history in their relationship with other nations of the world. I believe it's important for the background of Parashat Chukat in order to understand what is meant by Jewish history. Jews have a very, very special and unique way of looking at history. And maybe I'll demonstrate it by the first contact with the outside world. Revi, chapter 20, Pasuk 14. Vayishlach Moshe Malachim Kadesh al Melech Edom. From Kadesh, which was at the boundary of Edom, we're now talking about the area south of the Yam HaMelach, south of the Dead Sea. I would say the Arava Midbar Sinai. Jews are going to be moving in an easterly direction to come to the other side of the Yarden, the east bank of the Yarden, and from the east bank of the Yarden they are going to cross over into Eretz Yisrael. They are now at the border, the southern tip of the land of Edom. Moshe sends messengers to Kadesh, to the king of Edom, and he says, Koam achicha Yisrael, so says your brother Israel. You know all of the suffering, the trial and travail that has happened to us. Our fathers went down to Egypt, and we lived in Egypt for many years, and the Egyptians were bad to us and to our fathers. Vanitzak al Hashem, and we cried out to God, Vayishmak Koleinu, when he heard our voice, Vayishlach Malach, and he sent a messenger, he sent somebody Vayotzi'enu mimitzrayim took us out of Egypt. V'hinei anachnu v'kadesh, and behold, we are in Kadesh. Ir k'tzei gvulecha, a city at the end of your border, right at the very edge of the border. Our request, therefore, dear brother, is, na'avro nobi artzecha, let us please cross your land. Lo na'avor v'sadeh v'cherem, we won't go through fields or vineyards, we're not going to destroy anything. V'lo nishteh me'be'er, we're not going to drink from your water. Your water rights are yours. We will use our own provisions. Derech HaMelech Nelech. We're going to go on the main highway. Lo Nitei Yamin Usmo. We're not going to turn neither to the left, to the right, nor to the left. Ad Asher Nabor Vulech, until we pass through your boundaries. All we ask for is the right to use your country to pass through. We have absolutely no ulterior motives. There is absolutely no intention to wage war with you. We just want to pass through. It's going to be a shortcut for 3 million people on their journey to the land of Canaan. Said to him, Lo tavor bi, you shall not go through me, pen b'cherev etzei l'kretach, lest I go out against you with the sword. The answer is straight to the point, yet absolute no. And Bnei Yisrael said to him, it's interesting, the first message to Edom was sent by Moshe. The second, Moshe no longer sends the message. It's Bnei Yisrael that decide to take, let's try once more. You know, it could always be that the first refusal is just a negotiating ploy. This is the Middle East, most probably, they tell Moshe. And in the Middle East, you have to know how to haggle a little bit and negotiate. You know, as long as we're talking to one another, it's okay. All that he said is, what's the worst that he said? That if you come against me, I'm going to call a jihad against you. It's the rak pitputim, it's milim, the rak pitputim, it's not. So Yisrael sends a message from the Silon Aleph. We're not going to go on the main highways. We will go on a small path. And if we're going to use any of your water, we're going to pay for it. That ain't over nothing. But I want it by foot. I just want to go through. Vayome said, Lo tavor, you shall not pass. And Edom came out toward him with a heavy army, a lot of men, and with a mighty hand. This was an awesome show of force. This is not merely words, but action. If you dare set foot in our land, it's going to be war. Incidentally, let's not lose sight of the fact that Torah here is defining sovereignty. The definition of sovereignty, is, according to Torah, is who stands at the border. Who has the right to permit somebody to enter or not to enter? The man on the border, the one who says whether you may or you may not pass through, he is the one who has the rights of sovereignty. V'atzma'ut. Zot emeret mi yoshev al hagvul. Who's going to look at the passports? Who's going to decide who comes and who doesn't go? A Palestinian, an Israeli, a Palestinian, and an Israeli, a Palestinian, an Israeli, and an observer from the United Nations. Sovereignty is decided by who it is that holds in his hand the permission to pass through. By your mind, I don't determine Yisrael of orbit below. And Edom refused to permit Israel to cross his boundary, and Yisrael moved away. They were not going to in any way compromise the sovereignty of Edom. I think that we can assume from these few psukim that we've learned that Edom and the people of Edom and the king of Edom saw this as a mighty victory for Edom. Mighty victory. We showed those Jews. All we had to do was just move out our forces, a mobilization of all of our reserves, and they saw who they're dealing with. and therefore they had to move on. They're not going to start off with the might of Edo. But we know the truth. Do you know what the truth is? Moshe Rabbeinu reveals the secret in Parashat Devarim. Right? You have to know a pasuk elsewhere. The pasuk says the following. God tells the Jewish people, Al Tid Gerubam, don't start up with Edom. Kilo Eten Lachem Mei Artsam, I'm not going to give you from their land Ad Midrach Kafregel. You're not going to have even one shall, one footstep in Edom. Ki Yerushal Esav Natati Et Har Esav Har Seir. Because Har Seir, Seir, their land was given to them as an inheritance by God. Do you know why Jews don't cross the border into Edom? Because of a divine command. Let me explain what's happening over here with an incident. In 1959, I came to Toronto. I was not married at the time, as a bacher to the start of yeshiva. Came in May, yeshiva opened in September. Of course, I was a very conscientious Rosh Shiva and principal. I decided that I was going to look at the textbooks that are going to be used in the high school. I want to see if it passes muster as far as I'm concerned. So I'm sitting one day and I'm reading the World History textbook for Grade 11, Ontario. And I started reading about the Second World War. In the chapter on the Second World War, there were six pictures. Oh, I remember it like it's today. Six pictures. Remember, this is Canada. Picture one. A very bloody, gory scene. Dead Marines on the beach of Tarawa, South Pacific. Some 10,000 Marines were killed on the beach. Second picture, an American B-52 fortress that has been hit, coming in smoking for a crash landing. Picture number three, a Red Cross ambulance removing injured American soldiers from the field. Another three pictures. Canadian troops rushing ashore at Anzio. Two, Canadian troops mopping up a town in Belgium. Number three, Canadian planes bombing Germany. Well, listen, I'm a good American boy. I bought my, what were they called? The freedom, the savings stamps. Every Sunday I'd come to yeshiva. We had to bring money from home for those stamps. And after a number of months, you'd have a bond, and then you get another bond. And we collected tin cans, and we put together newspapers. Everybody was part of the war effort. And I knew that America won the war. And here I'm taking a look at a Canadian textbook. That's America. Dead Marines on Tarawa, planes going down, wounded being removed from the from the field of battle. The ones who won the war were the Canadians, no question about it. All right. So I see that obviously their view of history is a completely different one than mine. But I still don't have anything to go after them with. So I keep reading. And you should know, when somebody is lying in history, ultimately they're going to fall, and you're going to hear and you're going to see the lie clearly. After the war, they talk about the establishment of the State of Israel. So, is that me schwarz vor den Augen? It's becoming me black before the eyes as I read that the Jews, well-financed and well-equipped by world Jewry. I mean, you got the picture already. Nebuch, seven Arab nations, but look what they're up against. They're up against Jews, world Jewry. The elders of Zion throughout all the world have joined together to create this mass force that crushes the poor Arabs. Nebuch. I'm still looking for something, and then the next sentence tells it to me. What angered the Arabs more than anything else. Remember, this is 1959. It's a new textbook that's been printed in 59. Says that more than anything else, what upset the Arabs was that Jews captured the old city of Jerusalem and held it. When the Chabzer Bankop, it's 1959. It's not 67, it's 59. Jews are not in the old city of Jerusalem, and it's being held by the Arabs. A man is writing a history of the world, doesn't know what's happening before his very eyes at the moment that he's writing it. I mean, obviously, therefore, I was already concerned that you can't trust anything in the book. I mean, there are other things that I can't be certain of because I don't know about it. So I sent off, of course, a letter immediately to the publisher, and I get back a letter from him saying that he sat down with the author and they studied the newspapers of the time. What do you mean study the newspapers of the time? Right now, July of 1959, who's sitting in old Jerusalem? But this is the Narvish letter I received in reply. And it seems that I may have a point, and therefore there's going to be a reprinting of the textbook before the school year begins. All right. The point really that I wanted to make with the whole story is that there are different views of history. Edom's view of the events here, Edom's view is our strength and our might frighten the Jews. And the Jewish point of view is Edom? We were frightened by Edom? Nonsense! We listened, we hearkened to the divine imperative. God says, don't you dare set foot in Seir. It's the divine imperative that stands as a wall between Jews and Edom. There's another place in this parsha, and Rashi points it out so beautifully. There's going to be another struggle. A struggle against Sihon, king of the Amori. In chapter 21, pasuk 24, it says, "Vayakehu Yisrael lefi chorev." Israel smote him by the sword. Vayirash et haaretz. So we're going to come back to this war. They inherited, Israel inherited his land, may Arnon ad Yabok, from the Arnon River to the Yabok River, ad b'nei Ammon. They came to Ammon, ki az givul b'nei Ammon, because the az, that's the name of the place, az was the boundary of b'nei Ammon, says Rashi. Umahu chazko, the word az also means strength, the border of Ammon is strong and secure, says Rashi. Umahu chazko, what's the strength of that border? Hatra'ato shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God's warning. Sha'om Alehem about Ammon, God also said, Al Tetsudein, don't you dare oppress them. Don't you besiege them. What happens, therefore, the reason why Jews don't set foot in the land of B'nai Ammon is one reason and one reason alone. It's not because they're not strong enough or mighty enough. They're going to crush Sihon. And Sihon is the mightiest force of the day. They could easily have destroyed Edom and B'nai Ammon. Only one reason. The divine imperative. The mitzvah. You dare not cross that border. Is that the way Ammon looks at it? No. Is that the way Edom looks at it? No. This is a history devoid of God. And in a history devoid of God, it's obviously only man who plays a role. So therefore, what I want to do is I want to spend a few minutes talking about how to view history. I'm going to read, as I go through this, I'm going to read a number of quotes from a chapter, a very excellent book, excellent, The Faith of Judaism, by Isidore Epstein. There have been many theories of history. The ancient Persians believed that whatever happens on the face of this earth is due to two forces. The two forces are Ormuzd and Ahriman, the forces of light and the forces of darkness, and they are constantly in clash. The ancient Chinese believed that there were two forces called yin and yang, that are in constant opposition, one a male, one a female, whatever goes on the face of this earth is a result of these forces. What it therefore means, of course, is that man has absolutely no way of determining anything in history. To the ancient Greeks and Romans, history appeared as a series of cycles or circles of recurring events or periods. And it's something that's constantly going. Both Plato and Aristotle said the same thing. Aristotle at one point said that he believed that all the sciences and all of the arts had already been discovered in previous lifetimes, but that the world goes through a process of growth, development, destruction, and then you start all over again. The great historian, who wasn't such a friend of the Jews, certainly not a friend of the State of Israel, Arnold Toynbee, said that if we are to accept the cyclic theory of history, then what's really happened is God has played a cosmic joke on us. It means that mankind is forever going nowhere. And all that it will be is an ongoing circles and cycles of growth, development, destruction, all over again. By the 17th century, there was a new approach to history. That approach to history was the idea of progress, that man is forever marching toward the great, great tomorrow. Of course, when Darwin then came up with his theory of evolution, so the theory of evolution became something that was applied to all areas of life. The Bible evolved from some lower form to the form that we have it now, Bikkurat HaMikra, biblical criticism, and it was also adopted to the area of history, that man is constantly evolving from the lower to the higher, moving to the great ultimate tomorrow. It may also mean that it will be the survival of the fittest or the strongest or the mightiest in a physical sense. Herbert Spencer said, progress is not an accident but a necessity. What we call evil and immorality must disappear. It is certain that man must become perfect. Man must become perfect. The problem, of course, is what's meant by perfection if there's no standard of good and evil, if there's no absolute standard to which man must live up to, then how do we know what perfection is? Maybe perfection is something that we would call absolute immorality. But so here we have the theory of evolution, that man is constantly evolving upward. Rav Kook said about the evolutionary theory of history, evolution, he said, unless it is supported by an absolute guarantee of its continuation, is not free from the possibility that it might stop in the middle of its course and even go backwards. What guarantee is that evolution will continue to evolve? Maybe something will happen and the entire process will stop and there won't be any progress. How can they be so certain that man is going to continue on growing and growing? Of course, then there were others who felt that, yes, there's a possibility that history can end. The atom bomb, who knows? The man now has the power to destroy himself a thousand times over. Epstein quotes Bertrand Russell. Bertrand Russell says you can never have any guarantees where history is going. And I believe this is something that I've said a number of times. I just didn't know that Bertrand Russell also said it. It says that in history, there is always the intrusion of the unpredictable. There's always the unpredictable. I think I've said it here in a different way, that the rule in modern Jewish history is the unexpected. The haftarah, the surprise. You never know what the Rebbeinu Shlomo has in mind. But I'm jumping ahead already. I'm talking about a history that includes the divine in it. At this point, we are talking about a history where God plays absolutely no role. But there's the unpredictable. To quote Bertrand Russell, admitting that the great forces are generated by economic causes, and that's what many hold, of course, that economy is the powerful motivation for all historic forces. It often depends on quite trivial and fortuitous events. Which of the great forces gets the victory? The example that he uses is that if the German government would not have permitted Lenin to get on the train to travel to Russia, no guarantee that the October Revolution would ever have succeeded. And it was just a quirk that at the last minute they let Lenin get onto the train. I have other examples I like to use, too. The Battle of El Alamein, Eretz Yisrael, is in grave danger, 1942. It's October 25th, 1942. The British and Canadian forces, I think there were some Canadians. No, the Australians, I'm sorry, the Australians. The Aussies were the ones who came and fought at Tobruk. Huh? Yes, the Australians, yes. They begin the counterattack against Rommel at El Alamein, and this is, everybody assumes this may be the last battle if El Alamein falls. There have already been instructions given to the British forces in Palestine that they are to abandon Palestine and take up new positions in Mesopotamia beyond the Tigris and the Euphrates. And the great battle begins. Within 24 hours of the beginning of that battle, the commander-in-chief of the German forces, General Sturm, dies of a heart attack. Rommel happens to be then in hospital in Germany. Hitler orders Rommel out of hospital to get to North Africa. I wonder to what extent these, what Bertrand Russell, of course, would call the fortuitous events or the intrusion of the unpredictable of all the interesting things, things like this happen. The general in charge just dies of a heart attack within the first 24 hours. Rommel, the great desert fox, is not in the desert, and he's not too much of a fox. He's having his own Zuhussen hospital in Germany at the time. I also, of course, love the Battle of Midway. You know, I'm an American. The Battle of Midway. Yeah? Anybody ever study the Battle of Midway? I'll tell you, one of the things that I made certain that my children would know. My children know the names of the four Japanese aircraft carriers that were sunk at Midway. I wonder, is there anybody here who can tell me the names of the four... okay, so that now I know why you come to this Parshat HaShavuah class. The Hiryu, the Soryu, the Kagi, and the Akagi. Now just remember that. And here it is. It's the Battle of Midway. America has been beaten. You remember, of course, the 10,000 dead Marines on the... on the beach at Tarawa. And here come... No, those were the dead were the Americans. Only dead Americans. Canadians are just... they're still running ashore at Anzio. Okay. The Battle of Midway. The Battle of Midway. About 6:40 a.m. in the morning, the Japanese fighter planes take off and they bomb Midway. Some strange reason, the Japanese commander-in-chief doesn't know that about 200 miles away, the American fleet is moving in quickly. Doesn't have the information. His fighter planes come back and they decide it's necessary to bomb Midway again. One more zets at Midway, and that's it. The Americans are finished in Midway. But there are reports there may be an American fleet somewhere. He makes one crucial decision. And that one crucial decision is the beginning of the end of the entire Japanese Empire. It's all over. He makes a decision that we're going in for a second strike at Midway, which means they bring in all of the bomber planes. They start refueling, moving... bombs into the planes, and bombs are not torpedoes, bombs are to be used on Midway. And while they are in the middle of refueling and putting bombs into the planes, the American fighters appear. All of the planes are sitting on the decks of the four aircraft carriers. They are useless. The aircraft carriers are useless. There isn't a single Japanese plane with torpedoes in it to attack the American fleet. And one after another, the Hiryu, the Soryu, the Kagi, the Akagi, destroyed. The backbone of Japanese strength in the Pacific, and from them it was only, from that point on, it was already a matter of time. One decision. According to Bertrand Russell, this is, of course, the unpredictable, trivial events. Of course, what Judaism has claimed with more emphasis and more emphatically than any other people on the face of this earth is that history has an objective and a goal. And the history of the world is the history of God's involvement and intervention in the world. Because Judaism believes that God is not only the creator of the world, he is also the Lord of history. In davening and in Kiddush on Shabbos, we say, Zecher l'maaseh bereishit. We remember God as the one who created the world, but also Zecher l'yitziat Mitzrayim. Zecher l'yitziat Mitzrayim means that God intervenes in history. He hasn't taken a backseat. There is nothing that takes place in history if God doesn't will it, or at least if God doesn't permit it. There is a divine hand in all of the events of history, as one Englishman wrote, that the English will say, Nelson won the battle at Trafalgar, the Roman Caesar crossed the Rubicon, but the Jews say, and God took the children of Israel out of Egypt. A completely different approach to history. As far as Jews are concerned, and this was even said by one who had no love for the Jews, a historian, Dean Inge in England, who said, he said this in 1940, the Jews have stood by the graves of all their oppressors in turn. They may yet say to their latest persecutors, the feet of them that buried Assyrians, Babylonians, Greeks, Romans, and Spanish inquisitors are at the door and shall carry thee out too. So that what Torah says, and here this is the beginning of Jewish history, and when I say Jewish history, I don't mean the history of the Jews, I mean the Jewish view of history. Jewish history begins in Parshas Chukas. And Jewish history sees God intervening in the events in this world, not only on behalf of Jews, but God is also a universal one. And therefore, the God of Maaseh Bereishit is the God of Yetziat Mitzrayim. The God of Maaseh Bereishit means a God who created a whole world. He is involved in the affairs of all men. And therefore he tells the Jewish people, you shall not set foot in Edom, because I have given Edom the land of Seir. You shall not set foot in the land of Ammon, because I've given Ammon that land. What's really being told to us here for the first time in Parshat Chukas is what Moshe Rabbeinu is later on going to say in Harzinu, Zechor Yemot Olam Binu Shnot Dor Vador. Remember all that took place in history. Consider what has happened in all of the generations. And if you don't know, you have a responsibility. Ask your father, and he will tell you. Your elders, and they will say to you. When God gave an inheritance to each one of the nations of the world, Bahafrido b'nei Adam, when God separated men into different communities and into different countries. Yatsev Gvulot Amim, he is the one who established the boundaries of the nations. Isn't that the pasuk in this week's Sedra? Ki Az Gvul b'nei Amon, Az is the border of Amon. Who makes Az the border of Amon? God is the one who makes it the border. Yatsev Gvulot Amim, when he establishes the boundaries of the nations, it is L'mispar b'nei Israel. What he has in mind is the number of Jews in the world, where will they live, and that they deserve a place of their own just like anybody else. So therefore we're saying, number one, a history of the world that sees God as the Lord of history, not only as the Osei Maaseh Bereishit, but the one who takes Jews out of the land of Egypt. What this means is that this God, there is a moral character to this God, and he therefore imposes his moral law on this world. And we will see that anyone who will defy God's moral law, it may take long, but ultimately the lesson of history is that it goes well for those who are good and the evil are destroyed. Maybe not quickly enough for us, but that is ultimately the story of history. Because it is a divine history, and as a divine history, there is a clear moral character to God. This is a concept which is entirely absent from polytheism. The various gods that were fighting around with one another in ancient times, or in modern times, it's not the ancient gods. They don't sound as strange as the gods of light and darkness and yin and yang. But today they are economic activity and political power. Those are the yins and the yangs of today. And economic activity and political power become the most important aspects of history. They are also aspects of history which remove God as a player. They remove God as having any role in history. So we say, first of all, God has imposed a moral law on the face of this earth. Number two, God's concern for the earth is not only particular for the sake of the Jewish people, he is also a universal God. The relevance of these ideas to the Jewish conception of history is clear. It means that all events in the history of the nations, no less than those of the Jewish people, are to be interpreted as divine judgments. In the parasha, we have the story of Sichon. And let's take a look at Sichon for a few minutes. We've talked about Edom. We know already what to have learned from Edom. Edom, there are two conceptions of history. Edom sees the fact that Jews march away from Edom as a symbol, a signal clearly of his own might and his own strength. What he doesn't know is that they've received divine instructions. Don't you dare set foot over there. Let's take a look at Sichon. That's chapter 21. Pasuk 21. Israel sent messengers to Sichon, the king of the Amori, so saying, Ebra bar tzecha, I'd like to cross through your land. Shortcut. Loni tebesoda. We're not going to go through field or vineyard. We won't drink the water of your wells. Bederech hamelech neilech. Hamasher navor v'lecha. We'll go along the main highway until we cross through your land. Sichon did not permit Jews to cross through his boundaries. And Sichon gathered his whole nation, and he went out toward Israel in the desert by Yavo Yahatzah. He came to a place called Yahatzah by Yilachem Yisrael, the great battle with Sichon. By Yakeu Yisrael, the Tifereth, and Israel smote him by the sword. By Yidash Adarzo, and Israel inherited his land from Arnon ad Yabok. Two rivers, Arnon ad Yabok. Abinayamu. till the land of Bnei Amon, ki Az, as we've learned that already, Az is Gevul Bnei Amon. Vayikach Yisrael. It's going to be something fascinating, of extremely important contemporary events, but a view of history, Jewish view of history. Yisrael took all of these cities, Vayeshev Yisrael, Becholori Amori, Israel's, settled in all of the lands of the Amori, Becheshbon, Cheshbon was the big city, Ubechol Ben Oter, and all of the cities around Cheshbon. Ki Cheshbon ir Sichon Melech Amoriyu. Now there are a number of psukim here. I'm going to at this point repeat something that I said on a tape called After the Handshake. Very popular tape, Nebuch. After the Handshake, anybody wants information about that can get it from me after class. But there's another dimension that I want to discuss. There are going to be a number of psukim now that are going to talk about a city called Cheshbon. Ki Cheshbon ir Sichon Melech Amori, because Cheshbon was the city of Sichon, the king of the Amori. How did he get the city? He fought against the first king of Moab. And he took all of his land, not all of the land of Moab, but part of the land of Moab, until from the Yabok to the Arnon. And this, you know, there were thousands upon thousands of battles in ancient times. There are thousands upon thousands of battles in modern times. What we have to wonder about is Torah, which is eternal, and it's Torah Zemes. Is it really that important for us to know? You know, that it may be important to know the hear you, the saw you, the Kagi and the Akagi, but do I have to know that there was a fellow Sichon and he conquered Cheshbon, and you know how he conquered Cheshbon? Because he went to war against the first king of Moab. And what would be lacking from your spirituality, what would be lacking in your ruchnius if you didn't have this pasuk in Torah? I mean, do we really have to know about Cheshbon? Now wait a minute, we're not finished with Cheshbon yet. Al kein yomru ha-moshlim, therefore the moshlim, the balladeers, the ones who sing the songs of war, they composed ballads about this, the battle, you know? This would go down in history, like the battle for the Bismarck and the Chreis, all sorts of other, Saddam, Amitumtam, you know, then the great songs of history, about great battles. Therefore, we also have to know, and then, you know, this is Torah. This is Torah, which means that every word that's being written here is holy. This is holy. This is eternal. It's extremely important for you to know what the ballad is. The rock, reggae rock artists of the time. What was it that they were singing about this battle against Cheshbon? Al ken yomru ha-moshlim, therefore, the balladeers say, Bo Cheshbon, come to Cheshbon, tibone v'tikoni near Sichon, let the city of Sichon be built and established. Ki eish yotzom Cheshbon, because fire went out of Cheshbon. Lehova, a flame went out of Kiryat Sichon, the metropolis of Sichon. Ochlo or Moav, it consumed or of Moav and Bali Bomod Arnon. Oilecha Moav, woe be unto you, Moav. Another few psukim about Cheshbon and Moav and Nachamo, Moav and Sichon and Cheshbon. Come on. I mean, I can understand the pasuk, Yahavtu Le'acha Kamalcha, that's a pasuk. You know, Kabedis Avicha Vesimecha, this is a pasuk. I have to know about Cheshbon, I have to know about the old battle, the struggle. So on that, on that tape, maybe I'll leave what I said on the tape, I'll leave that for a second, but there's something else. Can you imagine what happened finally after Sichon won the war against Moab? There must have been great parades. I imagine a ticker papyrus parade along the main streets of Cheshbon. There must have been Festival Sichon all over the country. The great victory of Sichon. What Sichon didn't know when he celebrated that great victory, he didn't know a Gemara in Chulin. The Gemara in Chulin says the following. Four words, and I'll explain them. Amon u'moav. Tiharu b'Sichon, Amon and Moab were cleansed through Sichon. I would even give it a more contemporary translation. Ammon and Moab were laundered through Sichon. And I'll explain exactly what it means. This land from the Arnon to the Yabok, was originally the land of Moab. God said that you can't take any land of Moab. How did they conquer the Yabok to the Arnon? God said, you can't. I'm not going to give you any of the land of Edom. I'm not going to give you the land of Ammon. I'm not going to give you the land of Moab. In the Sedra here, we talked about Edom and Ammon. Azgavul b'nei Ammon. The same thing is true with regard to Moab. You can't have Moab's land. So how do they conquer the Yabok, to the Arnon to the Yabok? God wanted the Jews to have that land. So you know what he did? He let Sichon conquer it. And once Sichon conquers it and it becomes his land, the land is laundered. Now Jews can take it from Sichon and it becomes theirs. And that's where Reuven, Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh settled. You know what it really means? In the Jewish view of history, the mighty struggle to conquer Moab, Sichon thinks that he's doing this in order to achieve power, prominence throughout all of history. He sees himself as the prince of the times, and he doesn't know that he's the... Sichon thinks that he has achieved a great military victory, and he thinks that this great military victory is his work. What he doesn't know is that there's a divine plan that Rabbi Shem wants to give that piece of land to the Jews. So he needs a pawn. He needs a fall guy. He needs a front man. He needs to launder the land. How does he do it? He does it through Sichon. That's what the Gemara says. Ammon u'Moav tiharu b'Sichon. Ammon and Moav, their pieces of their land were laundered through Sichon. That's really going to be the subject of the entire Haftarah. 300 years later, Ammon is going to come and say, give us back the land that you took. We want, give it back to us, b'shalom, in peace. The first people in history who come up with the great plan of shtachim tmurat shalom. You give us territory and we will give you peace. So 300 years later, Ammon gathers its forces against Israel and says, give us territory and we will give you peace. That's what the Haftarah is all about. Give us, and he refuses. He refuses. Yiftach refuses. That we will not give any of our territory. We never fought with you. We never took territory from you. It was not yours. For 300 years you remained silent and didn't say a word. Now you want it? I mean, obviously he sees this as a provocative act of the highest order. But what's fascinating is in the Haftarah it says, Vatehi al Yiftach Ruach Hashem. The Spirit of God descended upon Yiftach. When I saw that pasuk in the Haftarah, it occurred to me, we had spoken a few weeks ago, we learned in the Haftarah the famous pasuk, Lo b'chayil v'lo b'korach kiim beruchi amar Hashem tzakot, not by strength and not by might, only with my spirit, says the God of hosts. It occurred to me that maybe the pshat in that pasuk is similar to the famous pshat in another pasuk. At the end of Eishes Chayil it says, Sheker Achein v'hevel ayofi Isha yir'at Hashem hi titalal. Beauty and grace are vain and nothing. A woman who is God-fearing, that's something praiseworthy. So the Mepharshim, Chassidim, everybody says, what does it mean that there's no value to chayin and yofi? Beauty has no value? The way you're supposed to read the pasuk is the following. Sheker hachayin vehevel hayofi. Grace is falsehood and beauty is nothing. Isha yirat Hashem, but a woman who is God-fearing, he titalo, she can be praised with her beauty and her chayin. A beauty and a chayin that is accompanied by yiras Hashem, that's meaningful beauty and chayin. It doesn't mean that Shlomo HaMelech is simply rejecting beauty and grace. I want to read this pasuk In the same way, lo bechayel v'lo bekarach, not with strength and not with might, ki im beruchi, only with my spirit, but with my spirit, yes, chayel and koach become meaningful. Chayel, strength and might and arms, if they are within the spirit of God, then it's praiseworthy. Vatehi al Yiftach, upon Yiftach descended Ruach Hashem, the Spirit of God, and he went out to wage war. He rejected the idea of Shtachim Tmurat Shalom. He rejected the idea of land for peace. He saw their demand as absolutely provocative, and he therefore was not going to acquiesce in their demands. So what I'm saying is, there's a Jewish view of history. In the Jewish view of history, Sichon is a pawn. A pawn in a divine plan. He doesn't see it that way. Of course he doesn't see it that way. Because he looks at himself as being the beginning and end of history. He is the great, powerful Sichon. But there was another thing that we said about this great battle. And that brings us back to the questions that we were asking. Who needs the story of Cheshbon? Why do I have to know about Cheshbon? What does this add to my Yiddishkeit, to my Frumkeit, to my morality, to my ethics? And do I have to know that Sichon acquired Cheshbon because he went to war against the first king of Moab? I mean, what does it do for me? I remember hearing from my Roshiva Rav Rudaman Zecher Tzadik Lebracha 35 years ago. Maybe more. I didn't want to... about 35 years ago. Rashi brings a Gemara in Bava Basra about the song of the balladeers. The balladeers sang Al Kain Yomru HaMoshlim, therefore the Moshlim, those who make Mishalim, say Bo Cheshbon, let's come to Cheshbon. So the Gemara learns Al Kain Yomru HaMoshlim, not balladeers, but rulers, those who rule over their inclinations. A man who is able to rule over his Yetzer Hara, Bo Cheshbon, let's make Cheshbono Shalolam, let's make the great reckoning. The value that accrues to man by doing a mitzvah, let's balance that against what loss one perceives from doing a mitzvah, or the benefit that one has from an Avera, and balance that against the terrible loss. Bo Cheshbon, make the Cheshbon, make the calculation. What does the Gemara have to do with the story? And I'm asking, what's the need of the whole story? And here is is it no more than a play on words? No, Cheshbon, isn't that a nice name for a town? Cheshbon, Cheshbon means a reckoning. Cheshbon, mashallah. I mean, are we playing word games? Our rabbis don't play word games. And then Moslem, Moslem means those who make Mishalim, but it also means a Moshel, a ruler. There's no game that's going on. Said Rav Rudaman, said the following, and we said it a few years ago in class here. Cheshbon was a small little geographic speck on the border of Moab. It was a flea-bitten one-horse town. It had a general store, a bar, and a jail. That's what it was. It was a little, absolute nothing of a town. Sichon gathers his forces for the struggle against Moab. He goes to war, unprovoked most probably. He goes to war against Moab. And the command, the high command of Moab gathers, and they say, listen, Cheshbon is a nothing. Cheshbon doesn't exist. We're going to send troops, men, material, in order to defend Cheshbon. It's a waste. Let him rot in Cheshbon. Cheshbon is the cesspool of Moab. Let him have it. So therefore they make a strategic withdrawal some 20 kilometers beyond Cheshbon, and without shooting an arrow, without throwing a javelin, Sichon comes in and he walks triumphantly down the one street of Cheshbon, goes into the bar for a drink, and he's there. Ah, but you know what happened? Sichon bided his time. Sichon began to bring in construction crews. He got the workmen from Romania and Turkey. He started bringing in material, and little by little, he began to build this flea-bitten little town into what became Festung Cheshbon. And by the time he was completed, Moab was finished. Cheshbon became the great metropolis, and from Cheshbon he struck into the heartland of Moab, and he destroyed them. Okay, Yomru are Muslim, therefore the Muslims say, Bo Cheshbon, come to Cheshbon, Tibane v'tikonein ir Sichon. In other words, they most probably must have written, you know, Cheshbon ir HaKodesh, Tibane v'tikonein. Because a fire, ki eish yotza mi Cheshbon, ki lehova mi Kiryat Sichon, a fire went out of Cheshbon, which had become Kiryat Sichon, the great metropolis of Sichon, and the great fire goes out, it's a flame. He used Cheshbon as a base, a beachhead, Keresh Kvitsa, I don't even know how they say it in English anymore, a springboard. Cheshbon became the springboard. All he needed was one little place. And that little place was the end of Moab. That little place was the end of Moab. You let the enemy have a little spot. You let them have a little spot. The ultimate story of Cheshbon is, God forbid, the fire can go out of Cheshbon. It becomes an area in which he brought in his chves, his kavushas, and his sagas, and all of his weapons, and that becomes the great Keresh Kvitsa, the springboard. What did the Gemara mean? The Gemara meant Moshlin b'Yitzron, those who rule over their evil inclination, have to learn from the story of Sichon and Cheshbon. Because all the Yetzirah really wants is, he just wants you to do a little Avera. You understand? Just a little Avera. Nothing major, nothing too serious, nothing that shook up about. Because the Yetzirah knows, then he's found a little place in man's heart and his conscience. That's all he needs. He needs a little place. And he'll bide his time. One little Avera brings to another little Avera. And before you know it, man is overwhelmed and overcome by the Yetzirah. That's how the Gemara saw the story. That the beachhead, Yetzirah gets a beachhead that becomes the springboard. So therefore they learn, Al Ken Yomru HaMoshlim, those who rule over their inclinations, Bo Cheshbon, let's make the great Cheshbono Shalom. But we dare never lose sight of the story itself. The story itself remains significant for all time. You give the enemy a beachhead. You give the enemy a position close to the heart, your heartland. You are placing yourself in grave, grave danger. That's the story of Cheshbon. So the story of Cheshbon and that ancient battle that was fought between Sichon and Moab is not something just like any other battle that was played out in ancient times that have absolutely no effect on us at all. On the contrary, therein is a battle from which we have something to learn in all periods of time. So that there is a Jewish history. Another few fascinating quotes that may be important. The idea that God is involved in history means that somehow the world is built on moral foundations. The fact that God is the architect of history means that there is a morality in this world. That in the long run, it is well with the good, in the long run, it is ill with the wicked. Then he says, in the course of history, opinions alter, manners change, creeds rise and fall, but the moral law is written on the tablets of eternity. For every false word or unrighteous deed, for cruelty and oppression, for lust and vanity, the price has to be paid at last. Not always by the chief offenders, but paid by someone. The lesson of history is that justice and truth alone endure. Truth. I'm emphasizing the word truth. Every false word. Letter. What letter? Who letter? That letter? No. Him. Jerusalem. Which Jerusalem? No Jerusalem. Oh! Falsehood! Falsehood ultimately must fall. Justice and truth alone endure and live. Injustice and falsehood may be long-lived, but doomsday comes to them at last. Arnold Toynbee, at the beginning of one of his volumes, one of his many volumes of history, the one in which he describes the 21 civilizations that have risen and fallen. He traces 21 civilizations throughout time. All of them, the law is the same. They rise and then they fall and disappear. That's why, of course, he was not a terrible good friend of the State of Israel, because the State of Israel was the one exception to what he saw as such a beautiful, beautiful symmetry in history, that nations, civilizations, rise, peak, fall, disappear, and that the Jews are coming back to their own land and establishing independence 1900 years later, it doesn't fit into any of us other 21 civilizations. So that's when he came up with his brilliant idea that what you see creeping around over here are only fossils, the leftovers of a previous civilization. But this is all dead, nothing is happening over here, nothing will ever come of it. But he, at the beginning of the fourth volume, he has the following words from Tehillim. Im Hashem lo yivne bayit, shav amlu bonam bo. If God buildeth not a house, those who toil in it have toiled for naught. Im Hashem lo yishmor ir, if God does not guard a city, shav shakad shomer. The guardian of the city is working in vain. He sees God as the architect of history. And he says the cause of breakdown is life blinded. I want you to listen to this again. This is the Goy Toynbee saying. What brings about the breakdown of a civilization? The cause of the breakdown is life blinded by anti-spiritual and unsocial self-interest. Anti-spiritual, unsocial self-interest. And then ultimately it is shaken and shattered by an outbreak of eternal discord. He and other historians see that the sin that brings down all civilizations is the sin of pride, is the cause of all the catastrophes in history. And this is a recurring theme in Torah. Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, and Yechezkel speak about the pride and the ego of the ancient peoples of the world who were destroyed. Tzor, Sidon, Babel, all of them. One more quote from Epstein. The root of the trouble is the egoism that vitiates all struggles for freedom. The egoism of nation, class, or group involved in the struggle. In all strivings for freedom, the principal motives are political and economic. We were discussing the great new Middle East. Great new Middle East. We're going to import shish kebab from Gaza, you understand, and they're going to import gefilte fish. It's going to be a tremendous new outburst of economic activity. Unfortunately, everybody knows about it except the stock market. I think somebody should tell the stock market that it should be acting properly now. There should be great economic activity. All right, let's get back to Isidore Epstein. In all strivings for freedom, the principal motives are political and economic. But when economic activity and political power are regarded as the chief end of human strivings, it is natural to prize those above freedom. And to go so far as to reject freedom when it clashes with the security which comes from the economic and political power. Man will give up his freedom if he thinks that it is going to give him economic and political power. Unbelievable. Man is blinded by the kisei, the chair in the Knesset, the Volvo with the telephone, blinded by political power, blinded by the egoism of great economic activity, and he may be ready to give up his own freedom and other people's freedom for it. I want to suggest that this parsha is called Parshas Chukas not only because of the Parah Aduma. The whole parsha is Parshas Chukas. Parshas Chukas is saying there is a divine law built into history because God is the architect of history. Zos Chukas HaTorah, this is the law of Torah. And we begin with a Parshas Parah Aduma, the inscrutable, the incomprehensible, the seemingly irrational and illogical law of the Parah Aduma. We can't figure out the Parah Aduma. In the law of the Parah Aduma, people who are Tomei become Tohor, people who are Tohor become Tomei. I believe Zos Chukas HaTorah, this is the law of history, because that's what Parshas Chukas is all about. Jews coming into contact with the rest of the world. Not only the history of the Jews as a nation amongst the nations of the world begins in Parshas Chukas, but Jewish history begins to operate in Parshas Chukas. People are acting, and they think they're acting on their own, and they're making a terrible mistake. They are acting because such is the will of the divine. Sihon goes out and his great battle against Moab. Do I know how many years it took him until he built up Cheshbon, and then until he conquered Moab? And he doesn't know that he's a pawn in the hands of God. The law of Parah Aduma, isn't it strange that it's the last halacha that's given to them? And right after Parah Aduma, 39 years pass, and Jews begin their march into history. I believe that the halacha of Parah Aduma is the way in which we're supposed to look at history. It may be inscrutable. We may not be able to understand what's taking place in history, but one thing we must know, that history is the work of the divine, and there's a moral imperative that is built into history, and anybody who's going to reject or deny that morality must ultimately be destroyed. Evil will be obliterated. The law of Parah Aduma had been said once before to the Jewish people. Right after Kriyat Yamsuf in Parashat Beshalach, as soon as Jews crossed the Red Sea, they burst out into song. You remember the psukim that come after that? Vayelchu shloshes yamim v'midbar. They went for 3 days in the desert below Matzu Mayim, and they didn't find water. They came to a place where the water was bitter, and they cried out unto God, and God showed Moshe something that made the waters sweet again. Shom Samlo Chok Umishbat. There God gave for the Jewish people Chok and Mishbat. And we once asked, take a look how strange. Here is the greatest peak that Jews or any people have ever reached, the miraculous crossing of the Yom Suf. Their enemies at the last moment are drowned by God, and they cross on dry land. What a great miracle. Can you imagine the joy, the exaltation, Zekeli van Deul, Ekeyodivar, Ramenu, they see God before their very eyes. And 3 days later, they are in the depths of depression. There's no water. 3 million people, 3 days ago, they had achieved the peak of success, and now 3 days later, Doshtik. Shom Samlo Choku Mishpat. And I'll just repeat briefly what I once said on that pasuk. God gave them their chok and mishpat. And Rashi says, what chok did he give them?
the chok of Parah Aduma. He told them Parah Aduma. Do you know what's happening over here? What's happening over here is God is telling Jews what will be the story of history in general and Jewish history in particular. In halacha, we know of the concepts chok and mishpat. In halacha, in Jewish law, a mishpat is something that everybody understands. It's clearly understood. We have absolutely no difficulty with it. It's rational. It's clear. Chok is something which we can't understand. Difficult for us. We can't plumb the depths of God's mind. It seems to make no sense. It's irrational. It's illogical. Rav Soloveitchik once said that whatever is true, and the fact is he said it a number of times, it was one of his themes, that whatever is true in Torah, in halacha, is true in life, because life is a reflection of Torah. And if there's chok and mishpat in if there is chok and mishpat in halacha, then there's chok and mishpat in life. What's meant by chok and mishpat in life? We can all understand a beautiful sunrise, a beautiful sunset. We can all understand and appreciate the smile of a baby. We can all understand and appreciate a beautiful flower. But that's not all of life. That's the mishpat aspect of life. In life, there's also chok. There is disease, there's death, there's bereavement, there's suffering, there's pain. Do we know why? No, we don't know why. But in life, there is both mishpat and chok. God wants to show the Jewish people at the outset, life is not all going to be Kriyas Yamsuf. Jewish history is not always going to be the divine hand coming out of the heavens, destroying their enemies, and they're going to cross on dry land. In history, there are also going to be periods of chok, periods that are inscrutable and you can't understand them, periods during which you ask, where is the Rabbeinu Shel Olam, what does he want from us? Why does he let this happen to us? But you should know that that's what history is all about, and you're going to be tested with Shom Niso, Shom Samlo Chok Mishpat. There he established for them the Chok and Mishpat in history, and there he tested them. Do you know when you're really tested? It's easy to have faith when you're going through the Mishpat periods of life. It's difficult to have faith when you're going through the Chok periods, and that's when you're being tested. What do you mean? You believe in God when things are going well, and when things don't go well, then forget him. I'm saying they were then told the law of Parah Aduma, because Parah Aduma is our commentary on history. We may not understand it all, but wait, the day will come and you will. Parshat Chukas, therefore, is not only the chok of Parah Aduma, but Jewish history is beginning in earnest. And in Jewish history you have to know that there is a chok. It may be inscrutable. It may be something that I won't understand. And chukah means something else. Chukah means everything we've been saying up until now. God is not only the God of creation, he's also the God of history. And by Zeche L'Maaseh Bereishis and Zeche L'Yetzias Mitzrayim, it means that in his world there is a chukah, a moral chukah. And the one who is going to transgress God's moral chukah ultimately will be destroyed. Evil will be eradicated. That's the story of all of history. It takes a little long for us sometimes, but that's the law of history. I therefore say that chukas, the name of the parsha, is not referring only to Parah Aduma, and I'm trying to explain, I believe, why is this the last halacha that they're given 39 years past Keheref Ayin, and there they are in their confrontation with the nations of the world, because that's the chok. You're going to have to understand that there are things that you won't be able to understand, but you also have to understand that there's a moral law, and if you're ever going to dare transgress that moral law, it's going to be at great risk to you, because ultimately evil is destroyed and justice and truth will triumph.